Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Language, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating. Today, we'll be talking to Herbert Terrace, author of Why Chimpanzees Can't Learn Language and Only Humans Can, published in 2019 by Columbia University Press. Welcome to New Books in Language, Herbert.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, so your book's thesis is really nicely encapsulated in the title, Only Humans Can Learn Language and Primates Like Chimpanzees Cannot. So in the course of the interview, we'll unpack your reasoning, but let's start with the big picture. Why did you think this was an important book to write? What is the goal of the book?
Well, about 50 years ago, I and other psychologists thought we could, in fact, teach chimpanzees to learn language. And we knew that they weren't able to articulate the sounds of language. Their vocal apparatus was limited. So Other techniques we used. One was to train a chimpanzee to use the signs of American Sign Language. We know that a chimpanzee's gesture, so that looked promising. And the other approach was to use visual symbols of different colors, sizes, and shapes. So I was a graduate student at Harvard. I worked with Skinner, who wrote a book called Verbal Behavior while I was a graduate student, claiming that language could be reduced to conditioned responses. And Skinner at that time was probably the major psychologist in the country. I believed him. I was always interested in language and the evolution of language. And then to my pleasant surprise, after I started working at Columbia, I read that some psychologists at the University of Nevada, Alan and Beatrice Gardner, trained a chimpanzee named Washo to use signs, and that was electrifying. I followed the work very closely, even though my work was with pigeons at the time, and there were reports that Washo could not only learn signs, but she can put them together so as to create a sentence. And I remember Roger Brown, who was the most distinguished psycholinguist at the time, he was at Harvard, said, this is like getting an SOS from outer space. So I visited the Gardners and I looked carefully at their work. And I said, this is wonderful, but it's not convincing because the work they reported was anecdotal. It was as if it was a graduate student, Roger Fouts, who said he was out on a rowboat with Washo, and they passed a swan, and Washo signed waterbird, as if it was that simple. But there were no what's called a corpus, where you list, like you do with studying language in children, everything that the child says. Roger simply wrote down water bird. Now, it could be that Washu signed bird water. It could be that she was drilled to sign water and bird separately. We don't know that. So I thought about that, and they said, I'd like to start my own project. And I arranged to get a newborn chimpanzee from a primate center in Oklahoma. That was in 1972. Had him flown to New York. He was named Nim Chimpsky. And I went about trying to collect a corpus of all of his signs. So that's how I started. Now, initially, I thought I was very successful. I collected more than 20,000 combinations of two or more signs. Many of them seemed orderly. Adjectives seemed to occur before nouns. Verbs occurred before pronouns. And I sent a report to science. They were ready to accept that when, by accident, I was teaching a new trainer how to work with a chimpanzee. And we were watching a session of an experienced trainer and Nim. And all of a sudden, I saw that everything I found was an artifact. It was an artifact of the trainer being so eager to get Nim to sign that about a quarter of a second before he signed, she signed and Nim imitated the sign. And it was unwitting. Nobody was trying to cheat, but it was just an overzealous teacher. And not just one, all the teachers did the same thing. And I looked at the films of the gardeners, and I saw the same kind of prompting. And I realized that my claims that a chimpanzee could create a sentence was an artifact of prompting. So that put me in a totally different direction about language in a chimpanzee.
Yeah. And so after that, you concluded that chimpanzees couldn't learn language, or did something else come in between that sort of experimental failure in the book you're writing?
I concluded that from all the extensive videotapes that I had, from the films that the gardeners made, and they had some tracings in their publications, I looked at a film of a gorilla named Coco that Penny Patterson trained, and in every instance there was prompting. I also asked myself, why would such a intelligent creature as an ape not learn language? And I began a movement in psychology called animal cognition, where I began to train monkeys that nobody ever accused the monkey of, you know, knowing language. But I taught them the same kind of visual sequences that psychologists like Sue Savage-Rumbaugh and Duane Rumbaugh and David Primack taught chimpanzees. You can teach a chimpanzee to touch on a touch screen, please machine give apple. Well, I could do that with a monkey. And I can actually get longer sequences, but they're rote. It's like going to an ATM and putting in your password. And that's not evidence of language. It's evidence that you can train somebody to produce a rote sequence. So I concluded that, unfortunately, apes seem to manipulate symbols, but they're not doing it for the purpose of communicating in language.
And so your book is in part showing this negative conclusion, but you're also, and we'll get into this in a moment, giving a positive explanation as to why there is this difference between human beings and even intelligent primates like chimpanzees, great apes, and so on.
Exactly. So I, for many years, just thought my results would just go in the pile of so-called negative results in science. But sometimes negative results can produce positive insights. And it turned out that during the years after I published the negative results, two discoveries were made, one in children by developmental psychologists and another by paleoanthropologists who uncovered about almost two dozen fossils of our ancestors that appeared after we split from chimpanzees about 6 million years ago. So at the time, you know, chimpanzees were the obvious animal to try to establish language. And we, you know, aside from Neanderthals, had no idea of other precursor ancestors to humans. But now we knew quite a bit about them. And we also knew, and this is probably even more dramatic, that human infants, before they produce their first word at about 1 year, they go through two nonverbal stages in which they first relate to their mothers dyadically, just in terms of exchanging emotions, and then triadically, where they both pay attention to an object. And it turns out that those kinds of relations are uniquely human. You don't see these in chimpanzees. And I concluded that in order to learn to produce a word, you have to go through these nonverbal stages. It also turned out that paleoanthropologists and linguists suggested that Homo erectus, an ancestor who appeared about almost 2 million years ago, probably produced the first words. There was also a anthropologist named Sarah Ardy, who had a theory that primates like Homo erectus were raised differently from an ape. They were raised by not only their mother, but by many other relatives called alloparents, and that in the process of satisfying alloparents, they became much more cooperative than apes and readier to relate to other individuals in a way that would eventually produce language.
Right. So your thesis then challenges, for one thing, Noam Chomsky's work in particularly situating language as the emergence of language in human beings as a very social phenomenon that requires not only certain biological precursors, certainly, and we can talk about those, but it involves a particular intersubjectivity and social coordination, attention to shared attention to objects and things like that. Maybe we can back up a little bit for some of our listeners. I think many of them will be familiar with the debate between Skinner and Chomsky, but can you explain why what you're talking about here is relevant to this larger question about language?
Sure. You know, the debate between Skinner and Chomsky started a year after Skinner published Verbal Behavior in 1957, and Chomsky wrote a scathing review of that book. And he attacked Skinner on two fronts, one at the level of the word and the other at the level of the sentence. And in the years that's passed, I agreed with Chomsky that Skinner's attempt to describe sentences as a chain of one conditioned response after another just doesn't work. However, I think that Skinner's definition of words was very prescient and very much in tune with modern views of how children learn words. And I think that, Chomsky invented a concept called the language acquisition device, an innate device which would automatically get children to produce sentences. But Chomsky actually admits he has no idea where words came from. And words are crucial for Chomsky. As he points out many times, the essence of language is the ability to create an infinite number of meanings from a finite number of words. But you can't do that unless you have words. And Chomsky, I think because he didn't want any kind of behavioral influence in his theory, resisted social factors. But indeed, there is overwhelming evidence now, and I think even Chomsky occasionally admits that, that to learn words, you need the social input of caregivers, usually parents, to establish first the emotional bonds and then the attentional bonds to produce the first word.
So this is trying to explain evolutionarily how we're able to explain the origin of language in a creature that didn't have it before. What is the need for it? What's the the benefit for survival?
Could I just interrupt you for a second? Sure. In fact, I'm writing another book, which has the working title, "In the Beginning, There Were No Words." And the question is, how do you go from the emotional signals that animals use to communicate, which are mainly to influence another individual's behavior, to communicating information with arbitrary symbols like words? And I think that that step is as major as the step from words to grammar. In the first step, you have to invent a new form of articulation. To go from words to grammar, you already have them, and the words simply have to be reorganized. So I think the challenge for linguists interested in the evolution of language is to figure out how you do the first step, going from animal communication to words. And I think that step implies another step where you go from animal communication to intersubjectivity, the nonverbal sharing of emotions and attention, and then you go to words, and then you go to grammar.
So if I'm tracking, the idea is that reference emerges not directly from animal communication, like bird song and dolphin squeaks and things like that, but that you have to have this intermediary step where there's the shared intersubjectivity among animals. Is that?
And joint attention. That's right. That's right. And it's so, you know, when you work with infants, they're so cute and so lovable, and you engage in all of these emotional and attentional exchanges, and, you know, everybody's happy. And very few people have thought about this critically as how that's essential for the eventual production of a word.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about that more then? So you're talking about shared attention. And I mean, if someone's not an expert in this area, you might think, well, I can see shared attention with lots of creatures. If I have a dog and I teach the dog, ball means ball, and we look at the ball together, and we share our attention. And isn't that a kind of language learning? So what's the difference between that kind of model and what's going on in human infants?
So as you say, you play with a dog and with a ball, and you share attention. That animals can do, but that's sort of like parallel seeing. You know, I turn my head and look at the sky, and you turn your head and look at the sky, and we both see a plane. But how do I know that you're seeing what I'm seeing? Our heads turn, our eyes travel in a certain direction, but we know nothing about your knowledge as compared to my knowledge. And the way developmental psychologists have gotten around that problem is they also add social engagement between the two individuals. So sometimes a child will point to an object and look at the caregiver and smile. And it's those social reactions that are crucial that you don't see with anybody playing with a dog or with any animal. And that's what gives you the difference between joint attention and shared attention. Joint attention is uniquely human. Shared attention you can get with other animals.
And would you say there's an underlying maybe this goes a little bit beyond your book, but an underlying theory of mind that suggests that the infant has that the dog doesn't, or do you not go that far?
No, well, I think it's the first step to a theory of mind. Mm-hmm. The theory of mind is a concept that was developed many years ago, and it involves beliefs and propositions mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. I think the first step in that direction is joint attention. Mm-hmm. And from that, you build up to things that would eventually give you what psychologists and philosophers call a theory of mind.
I see. So let's turn back to the paleoanthropology that you were talking about earlier. So you've moved from direct observation of chimpanzees, where you said, okay, look, this is not what we thought it was before. But now if we're looking to fossil evidence, we certainly can't directly observe the emergence of language in these contexts. But you do mention in your book things like a smaller pelvis and a birth canal, upright stance, and then you've mentioned Derek Bickerton and Sarah Rudy. What's the evidence for the emergence of language in Homo erectus in particular? How do you understand that?
Well, this is not a slam dunk explanation. This is a theory. So Homo erectus is a very interesting ancestor. Their brains were about three times the size of a chimpanzee's. And when you look at the fossil record from chimpanzees towards genus Homo, you see many creatures, or Sahelopithecus, for example, whose brains were hardly bigger than a chimpanzee. And then you get to Homo, and the first new species is Homo habilis, had a brain about 500 to 600 cubic centimeters. But then you get this jump to about 900 cubic centimeters with Homo erectus. And one fact that paleoanthropologists have discovered is that Homo erectus was the first ancestor that definitively used stone tools. That is, they can break a stone and make a sharp edge. Now, it's true that chimpanzees can use a tool, like they can take a stick and put it in a mound of termites and extract the termite, but nothing as advanced as making sharp edges from stone tools. Second point is that the size of their brains made them voracious seekers of calories. The brain requires more calories for growth than any other organ of the body. And one of the challenges of Homo erectus was how to get those calories, and the best source was meat. They weren't able to use weapons and hunt animals, but there is evidence, good evidence, that they scavenged. And the evidence comes from analyses. When you look at the bones of dead animals like elephants and zebras and so on, paleoanthropologists look at what's called a cut mark, and that comes from a stone tool used by Homo erectus, and bite marks, that comes from a predator like a lion or a saber-toothed tiger that bit into the bone. It turns out that before 2 million years ago, bite marks occurred below cut marks, indicating that the predator had the first access to the meat of a dead animal. After about 2 million years ago, we see that the cut marks occurred first in many of those instances, indicating that Homo erectus was capable of scavenging. So there you have a survival argument that Homo erectus needed meat, and you can get the best source of meat was a dead animal. So then the question that Bickerton raised is, how did they communicate about dead animals? I mean, you're in East Africa, hundreds of thousands of acres, that where individual Homo erectus go and scour for a dead animal. And suppose you find one, but then you have to go to your base and find fellow Homo erectus to say, I found a dead elephant or a zebra or a giraffe, and there are other predators, I need your help. Now, the interesting thing about that kind of communication is the scout who has seen the dead animal can't point to it. So the scout has to somehow communicate that, one, there's a certain kind of dead animal, and two, I need your help, and let's go and scavenge that dead animal before other predators get the meat. And you can't prove this, but Bickerton argues that that was the source of the first words. It uses what linguists call displacement, referring to things that can't be seen. Now, I thought about that theory, and I think that Bickerton, no fault of his own, is a very clever theory, overlooked the fact that thanks to collective breeding that Artie spoke about, joint attention probably developed beforehand, where Homo erectus, you know, might be sitting around and one points to a tree or an animal or a person and gives that a name. So in that manner, they established names for things that are visibly present. And then later on, when they have to describe things that somebody else can't see, they developed terms like meat or whatever they wanted to call it at that time. So it's different but similar to how children learn language. Of course, back in the days of Homo erectus, there was no culture. There was no there was no vocabulary for describing things. Homo erectus had to literally invent words, which is a much bigger challenge than children who are brought up in a culture where the caregivers know the words and they just have to orient the emotions and attention of a child so that they can learn to name things.
Yeah. So it sounds like there's a couple of things going on here that are these steps that you're describing. So one is naming, so referring to an object either present or out of view with a sound, an arbitrary sound.
That's right.
And then also it seems like something more, if not sentential, more like a command or a request that might involve that term, but it's not just this is that thing, but let's go get that thing.
Right.
So, so how do you understand the evidence that that these are, I guess, sort of the same, based on the same kind of process? So, because naming, you know, it seems like words is one unit. But then when we're talking about commands or requests, that seems to be a whole speech act, which seems a bit more complicated.
You're absolutely right. There's a fundamental difference between a request and indicating and referring. And I think we've seen with chimpanzees that they can learn requests. Those are called imperative, the imperative function of language. They can ask for milk, for a hug, for a drink, and so on. But it turns out that imperatives form a minuscule fraction of human vocabulary. If all an infant could do was learn requests, you and I cannot be having this conversation because there's no room for declaratives, which is the bulk of human conversation, where there is a speaker and a listener who go back and forth to share information. So it's true that there's overlap between humans and apes in terms of requests, but there's no overlap in terms of what linguists call declarative statements, and there's no conversation. In fact, I now define a word that excludes imperatives. I define a word as an arbitrary symbol that's used conversationally, and that is uniquely human. And I think that distinction has to be made to differentiate between declaratives and imperatives.
I see. And so is this then another point of contrast with Chomsky? Because it seems like he's prioritized the idea of the, maybe it's not exactly a contrast, but he's emphasized this idea that language is this internal, it begins with the mutation, we're able to use concepts. We have this sort of private thought that is then made exterior. How does that model map onto or contrast with how you're understanding language in terms of declaratives?
Right. Well, that would probably take hours to unpack. Okay. It's a very brilliant, interesting theory. But, you know, Chomsky, as I said, is not concerned with words. He's concerned with computations. And a few years ago, he wrote a book called Why Just Us, arguing that the computational system for language is what separates us from other species. He, because in part of the ape language results and their positive results, said words were not uniquely human, and put he distinguished between two aspects of language. The faculty of language in the narrow sense, for which only grammar is there, and faculty of language in the broad sense, which includes words. So I differ with Chomsky there, because I think words in the declarative sense belong in the faculty of language in the narrow sense. But as I say, Chomsky talks about words as a mystery, doesn't know where they come from. But once he has words, then he has conceived of brilliant theories ever since the 60s of the kinds of grammar that best describe the human ability to, that is the universal grammar of all languages, all 6,000 or 7,000 languages.
Yeah. Well, let's. I have plenty of questions on Chomsky. Let's go back to the primates and the chimps for a little bit.
Sure.
So, you mentioned sign language, but you also mentioned lexigrams earlier, and I wanted to return to that because you argued that even these cases where the chimps would press on symbols to receive corresponding items like food or tools don't show that primates can learn words. So. I want to hear a little bit more why, and also maybe if you can connect that to what you've just said about your hypothesis about human beings to really help us understand the distinction here.
Sure. So when I read that a chimpanzee named Lana, trained by Duane and Susava Drumbaugh, produced sequences like "Please Machine Give Apple" by touching buttons on a computer system, one for please, one for machine, one for give, one for apple, I said to myself, I think I could teach a monkey to do that. And so I developed a technology with touch screens, where instead of using lexigrams, I just had arbitrary photographs. And it turned out that it was not that hard to get monkeys to produce not just four-item sequence, like please machine give apple, but seven-item sequences. And they could learn many different seven-item sequences. And it became clear that monkeys can think in this sense without language, that they somehow could represent symbols sequentially. They're born with a sense of space. And that's what I'm sure the chimpanzees are doing. But as I said, when you go to the bank and you punch in your password, you're not creating a sentence. You're by rote putting in a sequence of symbols that have no other meaning. Then that's a way for you to get cash, just as it's a way for a monkey to get a banana pellet right. by touching the photographs on my touchscreen.
Right. But so is part of the idea that that ability to represent internally and to manipulate symbols in that limited way, that's at least a necessary precursor to the sort of thing that allowed Homo erectus to use proto-language.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that surprised a lot of psychologists, I and other psychologists created a field called animal cognition, which sounds like an oxymoron. You know, Descartes said animals can't think because they don't have language. So, and Skinner's theory is based on stimuli that are immediately present. It turns out that Skinner had no way to explain memory because all of the stimuli that were used in his experiments were immediately present. So the question is, how does an animal respond on the basis of a stimulus that's no longer present? And many of Skinner's students came up with examples where animals could do just that. A pigeon could remember a symbol it saw 30 minutes ago and select it when given a choice, and even though that original stimulus was not there. So the field of animal cognition was a way of correcting that limitation of Skinner's behaviorism. And sequence production is just an advanced case where the monkey, in this instance, can remember how to touch the photographs on a touchscreen in a particular order.
Yeah. So let me go back to, you just mentioned pigeons. And one of the things we do on this podcast is we ask our authors to tell us a little bit about how they got involved in the book's topic. And in your case, I think a lot is known about this. You've been a public figure for a while, but I'm just curious about the pigeons and the work with Skinner. What got you interested in these ideas, even as a graduate student, way, you know, before you looked at chimpanzees? What grabbed you about this?
When I was a graduate student, I did a dissertation which had the title Discrimination Learning with and Without Errors, where I trained pigeons to tell the difference between red and green or between a vertical and a horizontal line without making any mistakes. And I did that by training them to respond to the positive stimulus and making the negative stimulus so different that there was no tendency to respond to it. And then I gradually faded the intensity and the duration of the negative stimulus to its full value. I was very happy as a behaviorist. And before I got to graduate school, I always thought of language as one of the most interesting things in psychology. And I was aware that, in a sense, language is the Achilles heel of the theory of evolution, because evolution seemed to be able to explain all kinds of structure and behavior, but not language. So I was very pleased that Skinner took on language in his book on verbal behavior. But once it became known that other psychologists were attempting to teach our closest living ancestor, chimpanzees, language, and succeeding, I dropped my behavioral work, shifted to what's called ape language, and then seeing the results were negative, fell in with other psychologists to start this field called animal cognition, in which I'm still doing research on how animals think without language.
Yeah, and so you mentioned in the book other kinds of animals, and I know this is going just a little bit beyond, but one of the sort of, I guess, famous cases that gets talked about in popular media is the case of dolphins. And this seems right up your alley, sure. Because the claim is that dolphins are using tones and squeals to refer to each other by name. And that would seem to be in line with this idea that there's words coming first as a sort of a social coordination and so on and so forth. First of all, do you have any opinions on the research about dolphins? And second, do you think it's possible that language could eventually emerge in another animal like dolphins?
My simple answer is no, and I'll tell you why. It's certainly true that dolphins emit sounds, so do whales, and that's been the subject of research for 20, 30 years. And it seems as if the function of those sounds is to say, I'm here, and to identify one's position underwater. But there is absolutely no evidence that they function as names or that they're arbitrary. These are sort of inborn. You can't teach dolphins to make new sounds. So they're like most products of animal communication. They're inborn. They're emotional to say, I'm here. Sometimes to stay out of my territory. And they're immutable. You can't change them. You even see, people talk about birds and their songs. Again, the same situation. And you have bird duets, just like you have back and forth communication from one dolphin to another. But those are all hardwired, immutable. And their main function is to say, I'm here, keep out of my territory, and so on.
So if I'm understanding, it's something like what Grace would consider natural, meaning that this is just the squeak or the sound is associated with the animal's presence. It plays this sort of stimulus response sort of thing.
As a territorial. Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's not any case of dolphins sort of talking about each other behind each other's back when the animals are not present.
I mean, when I started my chimp research, my ambition was I'll teach a chimpanzee sign language, and then we'll go in the jungle, and I'll ask my chimpanzee, what are those other chimpanzees saying to each other? That's where I started from. But see, I don't think that's possible. And the reason I don't think it's possible is that there's no evidence that animals of any kind go through this phase of intersubjectivity and joint attention. And I think those are necessary conditions, even though they've been invisible for so many years for the production of language.
And I just want to be real clear about this. It's not just making the conditions possible for that. In other words, putting them in a human family or spending time with them. It's also about their biological structures as well, right? It's not like if we just put dolphins together in the right kind of place and then that would emerge.
No, they have to have the biological structure to do that. And I think the reason, the best answer I know of as to why humans have it and animals don't, comes from Ardy's collective breeding hypothesis that when our ancestors had to learn to please many parents, there was selection for that. And that selection brought out this hyper cooperativeness that is needed for language. And without that, I don't think you're ever going to get language.
Yeah, can you say just a little bit more about that? Because we talked about Bickerton, but we didn't get a chance to talk about Ardy as much.
Right, they both published independently without knowing anything about each other. And I think Bickerton described a more advanced stage of human development when Homo erectus engaged in what's called displacement. But Ardy spoke about why, in the first place, an infant would want to communicate with a caregiver in some arbitrary manner. And as I say, this comes from the practice of collective breeding, where, unlike a chimpanzee, where the mother is the sole caregiver for at least 6 months. If you want to get a baby from a new from a mother that's just been born, it's well known you have to kill the mother to get the baby. Nobody can get near the baby. Whereas in collective breeding groups, it's not just the mother who has the main investment in the infant, but other relatives, sometimes grandparents, sometimes sisters, brothers, even fathers, who look after the infant. And that makes it much easier for the mother to raise the infant. It provides an environment where there's input from various members of the group, which adds essentially to the, quote, education of the infant. And that, I think, makes a profound difference in the ultimate acquisition of language.
And so in addition to this, you have compounding this sort of collective
breeding.
Yeah, thank you. Also the fact that for human, or rather I should say Homo erectus and earlier ancestors of human beings, we have to stay with our mothers and our families longer when we're young. Is that correct? So that's also a contributing factor.
That's also correct, yes.
Yeah. So in contrast to the chimpanzees, where they're often running much younger, there's these times of shared attention.
Right. And we it's so easy to overlook the fact. Let's go back to our being bipedal. One of the consequences of being bipedal is that there's less need for a large pelvis. If you're quadrupedal, you have to support legs and arms. If you're bipedal, you only have to support two limbs. So the birth canal shrinks. If the birth canal shrinks, that limits the size of the baby's head and the brain that can pass through. And it turns out that the human infant's brain at birth is only about 25% of its adult size. A chimpanzee's is about 50%. So much of the growth of the infant's brain is after they're born. But because the brain and the nervous system of the human infant is so limited, the infant can't even crawl. A chimpanzee, as I've known from my own experience with them, within a week is literally climbing the walls and the bookcases. Whereas an infant chimpanzee can't even, you know, sit up or stand. So what happens with human infants is that they have to be cradled. And our ancestors lost their hair, so there's nothing for the infant to hang on to. The mother literally, usually on the left side, holds the infant and holds the infant in a way so that the infant's head is about 7 to 8 inches away from the mother's eyes. And we know that infants have a very strong proclivity for focusing on an adult's face. And there is intense eye gaze interplay between the infant and the mother, which again you don't see in apes, which is crucial for the first step of intersubjectivity. So, you know, back around Homo erectus, it seems as if there was a perfect storm of all kinds of factors, cradling, intense emotional connection between the infant and the mother, the need for feeding a large brain, that converged on factors that eventually produce the first word, which is absent from apes.
And then at that point, in terms of the transmission of language, and again, using Chomsky a little bit as a foil here, instead of a genetic mutation which continues and is selected for, what you have is a continuation of these biological factors as well as sort of social factors. And some sort of, would you say, cultural transmission of the word? Yeah, how would you characterize that?
Well, it's important to distinguish between biological and cultural evolution. And I think that up to about Homo erectus, most of the factors that influenced communication were biological. But once you got to the first words, what Bickerton calls proto-words, I mean, his theory was that for more than a million years, our ancestors only communicated with words. That, by the way, is a very interesting challenge. I've asked many students, for example, to play a game where they imagine their Homo erectus and they can only communicate with words. And that is incredibly difficult. You don't have any culture to teach you words, and figuring out what those words could be is not a trivial problem. But anyway, so our ancestors did communicate with words, and that was the beginning of culture as we know it. And eventually, the vocabulary became large enough so that some sort of rules were needed to remember a string of words, and that's where grammar came in. So the way our children learn words is both biologically and culturally determined, in contrast to how Homo erectus learned and invented words, which was more biological until proto-words came into being.
Right, right. Human infants don't have to, or rather I should say human adults don't have to kind of bootleg themselves into the idea of intentionality and reference. That's
because it's all there.
There right. for them, right? Right. So let's kind of draw things together here. Given your criticisms of Chomsky and Skinner and work which has preceded you, you noted that towards the end of the book some comments about where you think investigation should go on from here, and obviously you're still actively involved in this. Where would you like the fields that are involved in investigating these questions to go? What do you think people should be looking at?
Well, I think if I were a graduate student and I was starting my career, I would be a developmental psychologist and study infants and try to tease apart all of the nonverbal mechanisms that occur in the infant's first year leading up to words. Until a few years ago, everybody spoke of a so-called nine-month revolution when joint attention appeared. But an awful lot happens before that nine-month revolution. And what developmental psychologists do, and much more is needed, is they videotape infants and mothers, and then they synchronize the videotapes, and raters evaluate the affect of the mother and the infant, and they show how they're related. And all of these nonverbal contingencies are there just to be studied if people would take the trouble. It's much harder to study nonverbal communication than verbal communication, which is why most psycholinguists still work with children who have language. But if you're going to explain language, you have to start from the beginning, which means you have to understand nonverbal communication, emotional communication, before you get to that. So that's where I think I would go if I were starting all over again.
Great. And one other question for you. You mentioned that you're working on another book. You said in the beginning there were no words.
Right.
Can you say a little bit about that and other research that you're working on currently?
Well, the idea is that most linguists think that the challenge of the evolution of language is to understand where grammar came from. I agree that that's a challenge, but that's sort of like explaining skyscrapers when you don't even know how to build a simple hut. And to explain grammar, you need words. So I would like to use what's called the bottom-up approach of getting from animal communication to words. I recognize I have very little to say about getting from words to grammar. That's really Chomsky's department. And he's made brilliant contributions of different kinds of grammar that will work once you have words. But where I'd like to go is understanding more where words come from.
Gotcha. And just to kind of put a pin on this for our listeners, what's the upshot of all of this? What's why should we care about these questions overall? It's interesting, I think, for folks of us who are listening to this channel. But you know, if you were to kind of sell what these questions are telling us to other people, why should we care about this?
The reason I would care is that it has to do with the question, what makes us human? And it's clear that what makes us human is language. But nobody has come up with a good explanation of where language comes from. And to fit humans, in other words, Darwin said very wisely that we evolved from other ancestors. But unfortunately, Darwin couldn't tell us how we did that. He said there were an indeterminately large number of small steps. And on the one hand, we're very empathic. We're also very anthropomorphic. And we're very eager to attribute language to animals, but that comes out of our empathy and our anthropomorphism. But we don't know what the difference is. And to really understand what it is to be a human being, I think you have to understand where language comes from. And I think that's what the significance of this work is all about.
Gotcha. Well, Herbert, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciated it. And the book for our listeners, again, is Why Chimpanzees Can't Learn Language and Only Humans Can by Columbia University Press, published in 2019. And we'll have a link up, as always, on the podcast website. So thank you.
Sure thing. Pleasure talking to you.